In this hour number two of our show today, we will be looking at how and why the U.S. government and also the Western media missed the events that would lead to the attacks of 9/11. And our guest journalist, his name is Roy Guttman, and we'll be talking about what you can find in a recently published book that he has authored. The title is How We Missed the Story, Osama bin Laden, the Taliban, and the Hijacking of Afghanistan. It's published by the United States Institute of Peace Press. And in this book, he concentrates on what was going on in Afghanistan in the 1980s and 90s. He argues that the United States opted for a quick fix counter-terror policy there when what was really needed was a more comprehensive foreign policy. He also faults the news media for essentially ignoring Afghanistan after the Taliban came to power. He calls it one of the great lapses in the modern history of the profession. Let me tell you just a little bit more about him. Roy Guttman is a former senior fellow at the United States Institute of Peace. From 1989 until 1994, he was the European Bureau Chief for Newsday. He reported some very big stories, including the fall of communism in Eastern Europe, the unification of Germany, and also the violent disintegration of Yugoslavia. His reports on ethnic cleansing in Bosnia-Herzegovina won him a number of awards, including the Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting and the George Polk Award for Foreign Reporting. His 19 years as a Newsday reporter included 8 as National Security Reporter in Washington. In between stints at Newsday, he also was a Newsweek diplomatic correspondent for 2 years based in Washington, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions are always welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people try to keep their comments brief so that we can keep moving along, get in as many different callers as possible, but of course, your questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Mr. Guttman, hello.
Yes, hi, David.
Yes, well, thanks very much for talking with us.
And thanks for the intro. Yes, pleasure.
You certainly lay the blame all around. There's lots of room for laying it out. 2 administrations, one Democratic and one Republican, and also on the media. And I suppose, really, this project, this book, in a sense, ended or began with a little bit of self-criticism in the sense, as you explain it, that when 9/11 happened and we started finally to get a hold on what had happened, you found yourself asking yourself this question, how did all the media miss out on this, but you asked yourself, how did I miss this?
Yes, and I think that basically when something enormous happens for which no one is prepared, you want to ask, and it's like a Pearl Harbor, you want to ask, you know, were there signs out there that I might have caught in a timely way? Was there a story that might have been written? Was there some way to have gotten this before the public so that we weren't all caught basically asleep? And my specific thought was that the phenomenon that occurred, that happened in basically 1998, and it might have happened a little bit earlier or a little bit later, is that a state, and albeit a failing state, a very weak state, a state that was going backwards rapidly, nevertheless, that a state was taken over to a certain extent by a man whose personal ideological aim, and for which he was organizing a movement, was terror. Terror against the United States and the intimidation of the innocent, an attempt to bring a superpower somehow, to a lower level. And that this is something that we just really haven't seen in the modern era. It may have happened somewhere in the past, but it's such an amazing and terrible thing that it would have been a news story had we been noticing it at the time. And my question, which I asked myself, was how did I not spot this happening? And I have to tell you, my own answer is that I have an excuse in a sense. I was coming out of the Balkan Wars. I was actually preparing a book which was trying to absorb some of the lessons of the Balkan Wars, and it's a different book called Crimes of War. It's like an A to Z of the laws of war, bringing it down to the public. And I was so focused on that that I didn't really look at Afghanistan a great deal. But in the course of doing reviewing the book, as a matter of fact, one of the articles, one of the series of articles, was about countries where there is a war going on, and you know, how is the war being fought? And I went to experts all around the world, basically, and asked, you know, what are the most important small wars that nobody is paying attention to? And on the whole, almost everybody told me, well, Afghanistan was not an important place to look at. Well, how wrong they were. And, you know, one has to ask the question, what lessons should one learn from that? The experts, even from really respected organizations and from the American government, from the CIA, were not looking at this. How could everybody have been caught asleep? And so when I started this project, I went to the U.S. Institute of Peace, and I said that I thought that, you know, one ought to explore whether anybody in the news media was alert to this, were any of the pundits here in Washington, was anybody in the government, including the CIA, and they agreed this is a very interesting theme. And I have to tell you, to answer the basic question, when I started researching it, I found that there was next to no news coverage of the events inside Afghanistan, other than the mistreatment of women, for certainly the latter part of the 1990s and the period in question.
Well, just to pick up on that, and then I want to move on and talk about politics, certainly, but I suppose that some people would say part of the reason that there wasn't this kind of coverage of what was going on inside Afghanistan, and you could even go back and I suppose look at what coverage there was during the time that the Soviets were there, and then after the Soviets left, and then during the time the Taliban was in power, one would say that Afghanistan, through all of these many years, all going back to the Soviet invasion in 1979, was a very difficult and very dangerous place to be, and it would have not been easy for a reporter to get in or to manage to cover that story. You know, maybe covering war is always difficult, and it probably was. It was equally difficult to be in the Balkans, but Afghanistan was not an easy story to cover.
You know, you're absolutely right. At every stage, in fact, going back to the period just after the Soviets invaded in 1979, and yet, you know, that is the challenge in the journalistic business. Unlike diplomats, unlike military men, unlike even the CIA, and you know, almost everybody in those categories requires all sorts of protective details, and they have all sorts of restrictions on their movements. We are free agents as journalists. We can find ways around those obstacles. On the whole, in my short, happy career, my feeling is that, and this is maybe the biggest lesson I've learned, it is that when people put up obstacles, when they close doors, when they exclude you, when they do their damnedest to make sure the news doesn't get out, that's where we want to be. Those are the places we should be drawn to. And on the whole, there's usually some kind of a workaround. Now, it's not perfect, but I can tell you the example from the Balkans, because I remember being excluded from parts of Bosnia right at the very, very beginning of the ethnic cleansing. And my feeling was, in fact, I remember getting arrested when I crossed a bridge and went in there, that the moment that happened and I heard shooting in the distance, I just had to assume the worst is happening. They won't let me in, so I've really got to find out what's going on. And the only way you can do it when in a situation when they're locking the doors, essentially, is to find refugees. Have them tell the story. Why did you give up everything you own? Why did you give up your family plot of land, your relatives, your friends, to flee with just the clothes on your back and maybe one suitcase? And often the refugees can tell, if you get them especially fresh and if you're somewhere near the area and you can reconstruct the whole story, you can reconstruct a hell of a lot by talking to these innocent people who were forced out, under a tremendous pressure.
Mm. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Roy Guttman. He's a former senior fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace. He's currently foreign editor at the McClatchy Washington Bureau and has covered a lot of big stories over the last couple of decades. He was the European Bureau Chief for Newsday and, among other things, reported on the war in Yugoslavia and won a Pulitzer Prize for his reports on ethnic cleansing in Bosnia-Herzegovina. He has a new book out recently published by the U.S. Institute Institute. A piece, the title is How We Missed the Story, Osama Bin Laden, the Taliban, and the Hijacking of Afghanistan. Questions welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Really, to shift over and talk a little bit about the U.S. government and its interest or lack of interest in Afghanistan, here I think is a fundamental sort of bottom line point that you make and try to remind people that if, for example, if we go back to 1979, the Soviets invade Afghanistan. And then at this point, the United States is very interested in Afghanistan because it's still the Cold War. And this is one of these places where the Cold War was actually fought. The United States was providing covertly aid to the guerrillas, Afghan guerrillas that were fighting the Soviets. So we were very interested, and we were assisted in this by Pakistan. So we were very interested in what was going on in that part of the world. But then when the Soviets were finally driven out, here it was in the United States, we were celebrating, in a sense, we were celebrating a victory. We said, oh, well, we win. Cold War is over. Then suddenly, Afghanistan doesn't seem to be that important anymore. And this was right at a point where we really should have been paying attention, or at least trying to have some, you know, intervene in some way to determine what the future of this country now was going to be. And at that crucial time, essentially, it just dropped off the agenda.
See, what happened was, and I think any listener who saw Charlie Wilson's War, which it's still playing in Washington. I don't know if it is in Urbana, in Illinois, but it's a you know, a terrific reconstruction of how one congressman from Texas basically helped find the money to support the resistance fighters in Afghanistan. But if you go back to that period, what's so interesting is that the people in that film are almost exclusively, other than Congressman Wilson and his and Charlie's Angels, as he called his women assistants, the people in that film were almost all CIA. Now, the CIA is very good at carrying out operations and managing logistics and sort of helping the flow of arms into a war zone. And I think that what they did in that period was brilliant, as well as highly successful. The people fighting the war were, of course, Afghans. The people who would have to live in Afghanistan afterwards were Afghans. And nobody in the American policy establishment, this really goes back to the Reagan administration, especially more than even, although the aid started in the Carter administration, nobody in the administration, in the upper ranks, certainly at the State Department and in the White House at that time, gave two hoots about what happened to the Afghan people. I mean, on the whole, they didn't even expect that the Russians would essentially back out of Afghanistan, pull out in retreat, and that this would help bring down the Soviet Empire. Those were things that one could hardly contemplate. And yet, when you think about it, if you're going to get engaged in somebody else's war to the point that you're helping one side defeat an invader, you know, you do have some obligation, I think, to try to think of what happens after the war, whether it's, you know, or even during the war. What are the politics? And American officials almost never, with the exception of one or two CIA people, met with leaders of the resistance. So they called themselves the Mujahideen. They never, and even the United Nations, which was in a sense acting, you know, to fill the political vacuum and talking to the various parties and actually arranging the final peace agreement, or should I say the withdrawal agreement, they never talked to the resistance fighters or to their political wings who were based in Pakistan. So nobody ever sat down with them and said, how are we going to help Afghanistan after this tremendous battle? And it was really, as many as a million Afghans died in this war. But what's so ironic, and this is the way I started the book, is that, as the Russians are withdrawing, and by the way, Afghans were still being killed even when the Russians withdrew, at the CIA in Washington, they were celebrating it as if the victory was theirs. The truth of it is, as they say, no American died, that I know of at least, in fighting that war. It was all Afghans, and we did nothing for them. And that goes not just for the Reagan administration, but then for the President George Herbert Walker Bush, 41, as we call him. And then in the Clinton administration, they did much worse than that. They basically cut all aid, all interest, They didn't even try to do intelligence monitoring of what was going on in Afghanistan.
Yeah. It was really a terrifically sad story in the sense that during the time that the Soviets were there, the country was just devastated. And that then when the Soviets left, there was a government in place, but that didn't last very long. So here was there was a power vacuum. It was a devastated country. We had all of these sort of independent groups that had arms. And so perhaps it shouldn't be a surprise that suddenly what we did was we went from a guerrilla insurgency that was aimed at driving out the Soviets to a civil war.
You see, the first President Bush, I think, in fact, made some very smart moves. He appointed a man named Peter Thompson, who was an I guess he was a high-ranking official in Beijing. He didn't even know much about the region. He hadn't really been there before. But he appointed him and asked him to help try to straighten out the political situation in Afghanistan. And in a fairly short time, in less than a year, Thompson, in the early 90s, helped actually the one force that was the most pro-Western, and this was the man now known as Ahmad Shah Massoud. He was the political and the military commander for northeastern Afghanistan in the Panjshir Valley, and he was a real—he was a one tough cookie in terms of the Soviets. He helped drive them out as much as any official or any fighter. So Thompson helped organizing things and brought some support for Massoud, and Massoud was able to march into Kabul to take over. It was 3 years after the Russians left; they had had a puppet government in the interim. And Thompson really showed what you can do. One man, one diplomat, one person appointed to be responsible for trying to help the Afghans move ahead actually helped bring some stability. The problem was that Kabul was not a safe place even after Massoud marched in, and one of the reasons was because the Pakistanis were supporting other former guerrilla leaders, and in competition, and in fact, then in confrontation with Massoud, and the U.S. government, particularly the CIA, because it had worked so closely with the Pakistanis throughout the period of the resistance, the CIA basically was backing another horse. And so you have a kind of a competition within the U.S. government, no really single dominating policy. What happened next was that Peter Thompson, he was supposed to be the first U.S. ambassador in Afghanistan after the fall of the Russian puppet government, which was headed by a man named Najibullah. Anyway, Thompson was supposed to be there, but Kabul was too, it was under fire. And so he was sort of held in waiting for about 6 months, and then he was appointed to another job. And neither the Bush administration, the first Bush administration, nor the Clinton administration for 8 years, nor the second Bush administration, and nobody ever appointed another envoy to deal with Afghanistan. And, you know, I hate to bring something down to a bureaucratic explanation, but something as simple as having a single envoy, a single person who's responsible for not just reporting on what's going on in the country, but also helping craft a policy that takes into account U.S. interests, a single person could have made a difference, and that person was never appointed. Instead, it was just sort of left as a kind of a football. Afghanistan was something that was just dealt with out of the embassy in Pakistan. Mm-hmm. It was dealt with out of Washington, or on the whole, it wasn't dealt with at all.
And it seems you touched on what it seems also to be an important piece in this, and that has been all along the involvement of Pakistan. And it's Pakistan's interest. It is, after all, the neighbor, but also Pakistan's interest in having a regime next door in Afghanistan that essentially that it could control.
Yes, I mean, Pakistan has a legitimate interest in having peace in Afghanistan and a friendly regime, because when the British Empire retreated from South Asia, it left things in a somewhat messy form, particularly the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan, which, as you know, right now is the center of all of the violence and terror organizations. Basically, that is going on in South Asia. And the line was drawn by the British, by a man named Lord Durand, to give Pakistan a territory that the Afghans actually claimed for themselves, and it is now described as the federally administered tribal areas. The Pakistanis' interests and several Afghan regimes, you know, it depends on it sort of varied from time to time. Basically, wanted that territory back, and they, because the ethnic makeup of it is the same as Afghanistan. It was primarily Pashtun, and that is the same as southern Afghanistan. The successive Pakistani governments, of course, have resisted that very thing. So this is a very old border dispute. So the Pakistanis had an interest in a friendly government in Afghanistan that would not make those demands. But in addition, and this always happens when you're supporting a force in an internal war or in a war of resistance, as occurred during the Russian occupation. In addition, the Pakistani intelligence services, who actually had very close ties with almost all of the Afghan resistance, developed very close liaisons with a number of people, and they develop a kind of a clientitis. Relationship, or a client relationship, a patron-client relationship. And so they wanted their guys to succeed. And their guys turned out to be people like a man named Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, a radical Islamist, a person who basically was very anti-Western, who had really no interest in human rights or rule of law, who wanted power at any price, and the Pakistanis backed him, and the CIA for some time backed the Pakistanis, and here you have Hekmatyar basically laying siege to Kabul when Ahmad Shah Massoud, whom Americans helped put in power or let come to power, is in Kabul. So in other words, we have, in a sense, among other things, the U.S. Government at war with itself, but basically with Pakistan having a major role on what's going on simply because they continued supplying their friends. This was, this is the beginning of terrible things that happened in the 90s, because at a later point in the 90s, 1996, the Taliban came into power. And they were a radical Islamist, religiously based, but very much just power-centered organization, a very primitive view of the world. And the Pakistanis, I don't think they put them in power. Some other authors think they did. I don't think the Pakistanis did. But when they came to power, the Pakistanis decided to back them as well. And they turned out to be the folks who gave sanctuary, support, who hosted, who protected Osama bin Laden.
We are at our midpoint. We have a couple of callers that we will get right to in just a moment, but I'd like to introduce again our guest. For those of you who have just tuned in, we're talking with Roy Guttman. He is a former senior fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace. He is currently foreign editor at the McClatchy Washington Bureau. Between 1989 and 1994, he was the European Bureau Chief for Newsday and reported a number of big stories, including the war in Yugoslavia. His reports on ethnic cleansing in Bosnia-Herzegovina won a number of awards, including Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting and the George Polk Award for Foreign Reporting. And he is author of a recently published book that is just out now, and it's titled How We Missed the Story, Osama Bin Laden, the Taliban, and the Hijacking of Afghanistan. It's published by the U.S. Institute of Peace Press and is out now. If you'd like to take a look at it, I'm sure you can find the book. Just this news item I'll pass on to you. Tom Rogers, our news director, just handed this to me. It's hot off the wire. The Associated Press has learned that Mitt Romney will suspend his campaign for the Republican presidential nomination. That's all we have right now on the story, but I'm sure throughout the rest of the day from NPR, we will have more, and it will be a big topic of conversation later on.
It's real news.
Right. This is news, too. I guess we figure that even getting a better understanding of stuff that's already happened is really important. Yeah, that's breaking news. But, well, anyway, we're really pleased to have Roy Guttman with us. And questions here, welcome. 333-9455. toll-free 800-222-9455. And we'll take the calls here in the order they came in, starting with someone in Urbana. Line 1. Hello.
I wonder if we can go back even a little farther to, say, sometime in the early 70s. I don't remember exactly when it was. With I think it was the overthrow of the Afghan monarchy. Mm-hmm. And I believe that probably there was internal conflict already in Afghanistan over that, which probably grew. And then I think there was a fellow by the name of Amin, that's all I remember. It wasn't Idi Amin, it was a different Amin, took over and ran a rather brutal regime, as I understand it. And that the sort of Afghans' rebellion, or the rebels against this new government, probably began back then, but it's all rather vague to me. I wonder if you can clarify that, and also the influence that, or the attitude at that point of the Pakistan government for the overthrow of this. And I believe in Iran, the Shah was still in place, and what attitude he took toward that.
Well, you know, it's a fact of life that central regimes in Afghanistan do not have a great deal of power beyond the center. Simply, it's the nature of the geography. A country of, you know, where the Hindu Kush basically bisects it, with climate ranging from you know, some of the highest mountain peaks in Asia to the desert around Kandahar, is a hard place to rule. And so instability has been a fact of life there for a long time. And it's, on the whole, the central government has had to rely either on outside support or has in order to have any writ at all, and you know, all the development in Afghanistan you could speak of, including, for example, the big ring road that joins the major cities, has come in from outside. So it's a tough place to rule. And the Russians, you know, got themselves into Afghanistan in a series of missteps that were debated in the Politburo. It's very interesting. If you reconstruct some of those, which is possible because the, you know, the documents came out, the KGB, which we all associate as being this nefarious agency, under Yuri Andropov, actually recommended, urged the government not to invade, not to go into Afghanistan. But the political side, responding to the urgent calls from the Soviet ambassador, decided, and the military units they had in Kabul urged them to intervene. This doesn't, you know, answer every one of your questions of the inside and out outside, but there was a major debate in the under Brezhnev, landed Brezhnev, whether they should go into a country that was so almost ungovernable, and that where there was a party that sort of called themselves communist, but they were local communists and hardly a developed country anyway, and which had very little influence, and they basically went in to rescue this party. The role of the Shah, well, you know, in a country which has no strong central government, or a government which has to sort of make deals with everybody in the provinces, and has to come at the very best up with a kind of modus vivendi rather than a federal system, is a vacuum. Neighbors are always going to take a strong role. So the Shah of Iran basically did his bit to influence events in
in Afghanistan, and basically with American encouragement, I think, and there's little question about that, was trying to support whichever party in the internal context was the most anti-Soviet. When Brezhnev and company decided to go into Afghanistan, one of the major reasons they used as a justification was that the Americans are going to try to turn it into an American ally. They're using the Shah as their agent, and if we don't act now, Afghanistan will be lost for the Soviet Union. And the truth of it is, the Americans, in successive administrations, going back to Dwight Eisenhower, had many invitations from different Afghan factions to play a higher profile role. But the Americans had almost always ceded that role to the Russians, just feeling that it was in their hegemonic region and that it was a landlocked country and a hard place to get into, and hardly the place where we were going to make a big impact. So, so this is what I think you're getting at, is that actually, but the Russians were paranoid. They saw a possibility of losing what they thought was a friendly country. And of course, Afghanis will tell you, like in many small places which don't have a strong central government or an ability really to run things, they'll tell you often what you want to hear. And so the Russians fell for it. And they lived to regret it. In fact, that was the end of the Soviet Union.
Well, I want to thank the caller, and let's go on here to Champaign County for someone else. This is line number 2. Hello.
Hi. Yeah, this is so very complicated, and I feel so many misrepresentations have occurred. I haven't heard major ones here. I love McClatchy. I hope you do well there. But the U.S. did entrap the Russians in Afghanistan. It was a purposeful thing, and it was admitted to it by Brzezinski, who was kind of the author, and he dismissed all of the blowback by saying, "Well, what's the trade-off between the end of the Soviet Union and a few angry Arabs?" Or Muslims, I guess he said, because it was quite a mixed lot that became the Al-Qaeda. This dismissal of the importance of blowback extends to your other place where you wrote, in the Balkans. I mean, the Clinton administration, this is from the Dutch Srebrenica report, actually imported Al-Qaeda types to fight alongside in the Balkans, not specifically with the KLA, where, Akim Seku is now prime minister of the soon-to-be independent Kosovo, who was, as problematic as the fellow that threw the acid in the face of women when they wouldn't wear a burqa, one of our favored Hekmatyar. He was involved in the Krajina, helping the Croatians ethnically cleanse the Serbs. I mean, there's so many layers and layers. That reminds me of Joyce's famous line that history is a nightmare we're trying to wake up from. And I'm also feeling quite feverish, so I don't know how clear any of
that
was.
Well, let me just take up your point about Brzezinski. I've known Zbigniew Brzezinski for a very long time. I was already in the Carter administration when he was National Security Advisor, and thereafter he was one of the smartest people out there in thinking of how to manage a complicated world. And I think his judgment in many areas has been spot on. He's been very thoughtful. In the case of Afghanistan, he was probably the person right after the Soviet invasion who pushed the hardest to Jimmy Carter to provide covert aid. In fact, it happened even before the Russian invasion. It was in an earlier coup. The president at that time, and I think the National Security Council, thought that, in fact, a Russian military advance into Afghanistan, whether or not they could ever conceivably reach, a warm water port, as was sort of like the 19th century determinist philosophy that this is what they want. Whether or not that was a bit far-fetched, but the idea that the Russians are taking control of another country, creating a new satellite, in a sense, and it wasn't just Cold War competition. It was just simply, look what they had done to their other satellites. Look at how they had gone backwards. Everyone was a police state. That it seemed from the perspective of Brzezinski and others that this was something that was unacceptable. Now, and I think that in general you could find a very broad bipartisan consensus in support of covert actions against the Russian occupation. And again, I refer you to Charlie Wilson's War. Here you have a Democrat from Texas who basically became the chief supporter during a Republican administration for a much widened support, and he had, and there was no resistance. You know, there was nobody in any party who criticized it. The media barely even covered it, and I was a reporter here in Washington at the time, and I covered it. You know, just saying it's happening. The U.S. government is. We didn't know the exact amounts, but we knew there were enormous amounts of aid flowing. What's so interesting to me about Brzezinski, though, just to finish the thought, is that. He is one of the people who, in the late 1980s, as the Russians are coming under more and more pressure, the Americans are supplying ever more sophisticated weapons to the Mujahideen, to the resistance, including Stinger missiles, that at a certain point there was a question in 1988 or maybe 1987, should the Russians, and this was, Gorbachev had taken over and was basically describing Afghanistan as a bleeding wound. There was a question, so what's going to follow if the Russians withdraw? And Brzezinski was one of the people who said, we really don't care. But he's not the only one. I looked in vain. I searched every source I could to find somebody who really cared about the future of Afghanistan at that point. And essentially, the Eastern policy elite, and Brzezinski was part of it. Whether they were Republicans or Democrats, whether they were liberals or conservatives, whether they were media or politicians or academics. I couldn't find anybody who really said this matters, and we, the United States, have an obligation to help things be set right. And maybe the only people who really cared, or the people who cared the most, were conservative Republicans. They were the ones who actually championed the idea of a full U.S. envoy to the resistance, and that's how Peter Thompson got that job. They had a good idea, but frankly, in the early 1990s, it was such a mess that the Russians left behind. They didn't really depart. They left a proxy government in place. They were supplying it with an airlift that equals the equal of the Berlin airlift. And then you had the forces of Massoud, the most pro-Western force there, and then you had the forces of Hikmatyar, backed by Pakistan and indirectly by the CIA. You know, you had this messy situation, and so many Americans threw up their hands, including the policy elite. They really didn't give two hoots. So, blowback is what happens in a situation like that. You cannot, this to me is the big lesson. We, the United States, in a post-Cold War era, when we don't really have another major power that's in competition for us, that nevertheless, these small places where there's been a war or where there is a war, where there has been competition between the superpowers, these places have got to have our attention. And we have got, we have many, many other things to manage, but these things have to be managed as well, and that did not happen.
We have about 10 minutes left. We have a couple of callers. I want to try to get them in.
Sure.
And continue to talk with our guest, Roy Guttman. He's the author of the book, How We Missed the Story, Osama Bin Laden, the Taliban, and the Hijacking of Afghanistan, published by the United States Institute of Peace Press. It is just recently out, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. He is currently foreign editor with McClatchy, with the McClatchy newspapers. He also was foreign a number of years, the European bureau chief of Newsday. Just also a couple of more details on the breaking story that I mentioned a little earlier, if perhaps you weren't listening at about the bottom of the hour, but the Associated Press is reporting that Mitt Romney will suspend his campaign for the Republican presidential nomination. This effectively cedes the nomination, the GOP nomination, to John McCain. Romney was preparing to tell the Conservative Political Action Conference in Washington, D.C., that if he did continue with his campaign all the way to the convention, it would delay the launch of a national campaign and make it more likely for either Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama to win. Romney, in his prepared remarks, says that it wasn't an easy decision, but he said, quote, "I feel I must now stand aside for our party and our country." More on that, I'm sure, from National Public Radio when we bring you news at 1 minute past the top of the hour and later as part of All Things Considered. Let's bring in another caller here on our conversation with Roy Gutman. The next is in Champaign and line three. Hello.
Hi. I think Pakistan did much more for Afghanistan than anybody else in the world, including the U.S. And it would have been in the best interest of all the countries involved that they had, if they had consulted with Pakistan before they brought Massoud. Massoud, Pakistan has no, I think, had no grudges with. But he had no popular background. His power was concentrated in one province. In Afghanistan is not one province. I think Hikmatyar Gulbuddin or anybody else who had popular support should have been the proper choice. And if the U.S. government did not do that, this is unfortunate.
Well, I think the caller makes a very interesting point, especially your last part of it, is that you needed to have some kind of a popular plebiscite or referendum or vote, if that was conceivable, to determine, in fact, who should be the future leader of Afghanistan. And one of the real problems with it wasn't so much with Ahmad Shah Massoud, but it was his own, because in his own what I think his own activities and his actions, on the whole, he was he kept his power because he actually was a pretty sane and somewhat, so far as I know, uncorrupted leader. But he was a homegrown nationalist, and a homegrown. Actually, he called himself an Islamist, but he was a moderate compared to some of the people that Pakistan was backing. The problem was that he didn't have a good grasp of politics and how to operate it, and he relied on people like a man named President Rabbani, who is instead of trying to open up the process and bring in other groups besides the Tajiks, who are a minority in Pakistan, he basically was eager just to stay in power. So there was a real political problem. And what the Americans did, and this is Peter Thompson in particular, but other American officials as well, was to urge Massoud and Rabbani to broaden the political opening and to somehow have some kind of a national meeting. It might have just been a grand assembly, the Loya Jirga, or it might have been something broader, but some way of bringing in the outside, bringing in other ethnic groups into a central government. The problem with the Pakistani participation there is that Pakistan was backing one horse whose own popular support in Afghanistan was very, very dubious, who was a ruthless commander who bombarded Kabul and caused much more damage to it than the Russians ever did. And in fact, he was creating and running a civil war. The Pakistanis backed him consistently. I think one has to have a lot of respect for Pakistan's role during the resistance because it did make it all possible, and there was definite risk for Pakistan. But that did not give Pakistan the right or legitimacy after the end of the resistance to say, this is our country. Again, it was not Pakistanis who were fighting in Afghanistan, except for maybe some volunteers. It was Afghans. It's their country. And what you must do in a situation like that is somehow find a way to bring together the broadest coalition of local leaders to determine how the country is going to be run afterwards. Instead, Pakistan, through the intelligence directorate, was much more tuned into pursuing its own interests through its own clients. That almost always fails. You know, in the short term, it may work. In the longer term, it always leads to calamity.
Yeah. Ahmad Shah Massoud was killed in the fall of 2001, so that effectively took him out of the picture. He was not able to have any further influence. But I think one of the things about him that was noteworthy is that he always seemed to feel very strongly, as you say, that it should be Afghans who would make the decision about the future of their country. And he was very concerned about the influence of outsiders, particularly Pakistan.
Massoud was almost allergic to the Pakistanis. I mean, behind every bush, when somebody was fighting, and this is an interesting discovery I made in the research, my contention is that in the period that he was in power from 92 to 96, he basically had a very hard time running the country. When the Taliban forced him out of power, he became the principal resistance. He became a very, very interesting man, because he basically had to consider both his own failures in power, but also what he would do if he got back into power. And the Taliban, when they took over Kabul, basically wanted the whole country, as any government will. And he was the principal resistance. So as they got better in fighting him, I think he tried, through his own intelligence means, to figure out how are they doing it. And he kept on finding the hand of Pakistan. And it may be true that the Pakistanis, I know they gave a lot of political, diplomatic, and military aid to the Taliban. But he saw Pakistanis behind every bush. He basically saw Pakistani officers in there directing the Taliban, and yet, nobody was ever able to prove this. No journalist has ever proven this, no Pakistani journalist, so I don't know quite what the truth of that is. And but what he overlooked, I think, although it came in at a later point, was the role of bin Laden, the role of al-Qaeda volunteers, the role of the training camps. In other words, I don't know that Massoud, with all of his own brilliance and his own knowledge of the country, quite understood himself what the role of, which is one of the themes of this book, of bin Laden became in the late 1990s.
And what you argue here, and unfortunately we only have a couple of minutes left, is the degree to which bin Laden, in a sense, made the Taliban beholden to him, reorganized it, penetrated it. So in essentially, we have come to a situation where bin Laden really is able to control the Taliban, and the Taliban are the power in the country.
And that's the story. That's the story we missed. That's the story that I'm trying to retell here. I think it's a vital one, because you have to understand, it's a little bit obscure in some ways. It's got a lot of names attached to it. But this is the nitty-gritty of what happened in the run-up to 9/11. It was that the Taliban were not able to defeat Massoud. They had to rely on bin Laden. Bin Laden saw the vacuum and guided them. So they became truly beholden to the man. It was bin Laden's people who assassinated Massoud just before 9/11, 2 days before 9/11. And it was bin Laden who had done so much for the Taliban in helping them capture so much of the country that they could not kick out. And when that became clear, and my contention is that, and it's an assessment that it became clear by 1998 or early 1999, it was at that moment that U.S. policy had to shift, because you were no longer dealing with just simply a rogue person who was living in another country. No, you were dealing with a country that was protecting a rogue whose aim was to cause enormous damage to the United States.
Mm-hmm. And the important point is that you're suggesting that at least it would have been more possible if the United States had been paying more attention to what was going on there as this was developing, that we should have had the opportunity to be involved in a different way, but that once we get to this point, that there's really there would not have been many other good options other than being involved militarily.
There's no great option available in most of these situations, but in this particular case, Massoud was a very good option because he had the capability of mounting all sorts of attacks against the Taliban and distracting them and also distracting the bin Laden people. But he had no money, didn't have a radio station, was operating on a threadbare budget, really hand to mouth, and it would have been so simple to support the guy. But the Clinton administration, for reasons I still can't quite comprehend, basically wrote him off as a minor figure and just one of the contending figures in the internal thing. And the administration stayed with the Taliban almost to the end, in a sense that they were neutral in an internal conflict where they really have to have taken sides.
Yeah. And that again sort of goes back to this idea that we really didn't see that we had much stake in what happened and in this struggle for power that was going on there.
Well, it's amazing. You know, David, you don't actually have to send in the 82nd Airborne into every conflict zone. You don't have to you don't have to set up a special CIA station. You don't have to create an embassy in a third country. You just but even doing the minimum will allow you to understand things better. And in this case, the minimum was they should have had a special envoy. They should have directed the CIA to gather intelligence and the political guys the diplomats to gather intelligence. They should have had a focus on this in Washington. They could have talked to the refugees who were fleeing, because the refugees always have such harrowing tales, but they also explain what is really going on. They could have monitored the internal fighting. Instead, it turns out when the Taliban, with the aid of bin Laden, in about the year 2000, delivered a huge defeat to Massoud, everybody in the administration was caught asleep. They didn't even know it had happened. They thought that Massoud was going to hold his own, forever. They didn't, and they didn't understand. And because they didn't understand the internal conflict, and frankly, here I fault the media as well. We didn't cover it. You know, you'd find like one paragraph when written in the New York Times, of all places, when a huge amount of territory was lost by Massoud. We were not following it. We were not putting it on the map, which we should have. So I can't blame the administration alone. But on the other hand, I mean, they are the government. We are just supposedly the watchdogs, the reporters. But this is the problem. We all failed. And the object of writing a book like this is to do a postmortem and to say, here are the lessons we've got to learn from this.
Well, if people want to look at the book, it's How We Missed the Story: Osama bin Laden, the Taliban, and the Hijacking of Afghanistan. It's published by the United States Institute of Peace Press by our guest, Roy Guttman. He is a foreign editor for McClatchy Newspapers. And Mr. Guttman, thanks very much.
Well, it's a pleasure to be there. And thanks to your listeners for calling in, too.